Headlines. Iran's foreign minister attends the Joint Economic Cooperation Commission in South Africa as part of efforts to boost bilateral ties between Tehran and Pretoria. Palestinians hold a funeral procession for a young man killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. And at least 17 Rohingya Muslims fleeing Myanmar lose their lives after their boat breaks up as the crackdown on the world's most persecuted minority rages on. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Tehran and Pretoria signed a joint statement of cooperation as the Iranian foreign minister visits South Africa. Hossein Amir Abdullahian and his South African counterpart, Naledi Pandor, signed the document after the 15th session of the Joint Commission on Cooperation. Earlier, the two ministers held a press conference where Amir Abdullahian said Iran considers BRICS as a platform for enhancing multilateralism. He also said Tehran is looking forward to broadening ties in all fields, including science, technology, and energy. In turn, Pandor said South Africa was specifically willing to boost interaction in oil and gas industries. The Iranian foreign minister is expected to sit down with other high-ranking South African officials during his day-long trip. Our correspondent Gisumisha Ahmadi joined us earlier from Pretoria to give us updates on the topics discussed by the Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, and his South African counterpart.
He did mention the fact that there is a roadmap that has been put out both by him and his South African counterpart in order to expand economic relations. Currently, the two countries are considered important economies and they have large economies, but in proportion to that amount of economic transactions, the bilateral relations between the two countries still has great potential to expand, and this is what they're working on. They already have a roadmap for that. And also, Bardia, the South African foreign minister reiterated these comments made by the Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian. She also pointed to a very important issue, and that was the unilateral sanctions imposed on Iran and, of course, a number of other countries across the world. And she, of course, did not mince her words, saying that unilateral sanctions are unacceptable. The only organization which is allowed to impose sanctions based on international law is the United Nations Security Council. And that led her to explain how the United Nations has moved away from its original charter, from its original mission, and that the UNSC needs to rewrite its mission and move back to what it was created for and go down that path rather than being a tool at the hand of a number of specific countries.
Iranian police forces have arrested a member of the Daesh terrorist group operating in the southeastern province of Sistan and Balochistan. Police commander said the individual had Iranian citizenship and was promoting Daesh in the region. The terrorist group was also involved in last year's deadly attack on a holy shrine in the city of Shiraz. The act of terror on October 26 left 13 people dead. Daesh has also claimed earlier deadly acts of violence in Iran, including twin attacks in Tehran in 2017 that targeted parliament and the Imam Khomeini shrine. Palestinians laid to rest the body of a youth killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Hundreds of Palestinians took part in a funeral procession of Amir Abu Khalifa. He was shot dead during a raid on Zawata, a town in the Nablus governorate. Palestinian resistance groups have offered their condolences to the family of Khalifa, saying that the fight against the Israeli regime will continue until victory. Israel has been carrying out deadly raids across the occupied territories almost on a daily basis. More than 200 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli onslaughts since the start of the year. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, shed more light on the latest Israeli killing in the occupied West Bank.
Israeli forces raided the Zawata village near Nablus in northern occupied West Bank early Thursday in order to conduct arrests among Palestinians This is what the Israelis usually say when they raid Palestinian areas. They say the main aim is to arrest Palestinians. And during this raid, there were reports about exchange of firing clashes between Palestinians and Israeli forces. Later, the Palestinian Ministry of Health said Amir Abu Khalifa from Al Ain refugee camp near Zawata village was killed by the Israeli forces as he was shot during the raid to Zawata village. The Israelis then said that Amir Abu Khalifa was one of the wanted Palestinians. He was one of the active fighters, and that the Israeli forces were searching for Amir Abu Khalifa in order to arrest him. It's not clear if the raid to Zawata was meant to arrest Palestinians and including Amir Abu Khalifa.
On to Bahrain. People have taken to the streets late Wednesday in support of political prisoners on hunger strike at the notorious Jal prison. The major grievance of the prisoners is that authorities have banned worshipping and have denied them adequate health care. Bahraini rights activists say two prison blocks of the facility started the strike on Monday. Three others began the strike on Tuesday. A statement by the Al-Wafaq group said some 20 prisoners have so far fainted due to the hunger strike. Bahrain is in the midst of a decade-long crackdown on the Shia majority and other communities demanding more political freedom. Massive protests first erupted in 2011. At the time, the kingdom crushed demonstrations with the help of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Trapped in statelessness, Rohingya Muslims continue to face plight in their country of birth. Yet another tragic incident, at least 17 Rohingya have drowned while fleeing persecution in Myanmar's Rakhine State. Rescuers from a charity say that a boat with more than 50 people was heading for Malaysia when it broke up at sea on Sunday night. They have found 8 people alive and continue the search for the missing ones. Rohingya risk their lives each year to reach Malaysia and Indonesia. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya crossed into Bangladesh in 2017 after Myanmar's military and Buddhist groups started clamping down on them. There were numerous reports of mass killings and gang rapes of Rohingya men and women, as well as arson attacks. The UN has described Rohingya as the most persecuted minority in the world and their tragedy as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Britain has moved dozens of asylum seekers to a large residential barge on its southern coast. Authorities have to eventually transfer up to 500 men to the three-story floating accommodation block. The barge can house virtually 500 people in over 200 bedrooms while they await the outcome of their asylum application. Now, this policy has raised concerns among rights groups.
Britain has moved dozens of asylum seekers to a large residential barge on its southern coast. The migrants were moved onto the 222-room Bibby Stockholm, which docked off the Dorset coast nearly 3 weeks ago. Authorities hope to eventually transfer up to 500 men between the ages of 18 and 65 to the three-story floating accommodation block while they await the outcome of their asylum application.
We have had a few challenges, but this is part of an ongoing structured process to bring a cohort of up to 500 people on board. There have been some challenges, some minor legal challenges, and I can't go into the detail of those, but we are all accommodation is offered to all individuals on a no-choice basis.
This despite safety warnings from the Fire Brigades Union, which has raised concerns over the narrow exits and possible overcrowding. The government says it wants to limit the pull factors attracting asylum seekers to Britain. Authorities claim more than 50,000 are currently living in hotels after they made the final part of their journey in small dinghies across the English Channel.
Accommodation for migrants should meet their essential living needs and nothing more, because we cannot risk becoming a magnet for the millions of people who are displaced and seeking better economic prospects. I've said before that we have to suffuse our entire system with deterrence, and this must include how we house illegal migrants.
Officials say they're costing the taxpayer more than £6 million a day. They say plans for alternative accommodation, including two more barges and three ex-military bases in East Sussex, Essex and Lancashire, offered better value. However, the full costs of the barge have not been disclosed, with refugee campaign group Reclaim the Sea claiming the Bibby Stockholm would cost more than hotels. The Home Office has ramped up hostile policies towards refugees in a bid to reduce the number of small boat crossings in the face of the European migrant crisis.
That, you know, there's some, it's a little bit reasonable, but of course, one of the issues we have with this situation and this barge is that there isn't transparency about the money that they're saving. So on the one hand, I understand trying to save taxpayer money, but on the other hand, there's no transparency about if this is even saving money at all. And furthermore, there's the real issue is the backlog. I mean, the money should go into, resources should go into addressing the backlog of asylum seekers rather than putting them on barges for, an undetermined amount of time.
The controversial move showcases the latest example of a steady hardening of migration policy under the governing Conservative Party led by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Every year, thousands of asylum seekers travel to Britain on small dinghies, risking their lives to cross the English Channel. Now, more than 50,000 of these desperate people are living in hotels, waiting for the result of their asylum claims.
Plans to house migrants on the vessel have sparked controversy in Britain. Some human rights groups have called the scheme inhumane, but ministers insist it's safe and will save money. Human rights groups have voiced concern over London's decision to house migrants on the barge. Freedom from Torture, which provides therapeutic care for survivors of torture seeking protection in the UK, is amongst those groups. It says the government should stop forcing refugees to live in unsafe and undignified accommodation. Refugee charity Care for Calais has also said the move to house refugees on the Bibby Stockholm is, quote, causing a huge amount of anxiety.
What you've got is a situation where people who've been through potentially torture, detention, kidnapping, conflict, persecution, possibly risk at sea, maybe crossing the Med or the Channel, being almost picked at random to be shoved on board the barge.
The number of people risking the treacherous crossing between Britain and France has been fueled by war, global inequality, and the climate crisis. In 2022, 45,755 people crossed in small boats, heaping pressure on an immigration system that critics warn is broken and underfunded. The use of the Bibby Stockholm is part of a raft of measures by the Conservative government intended to slash the cost of housing migrants in hotels and ease the backlog of unprocessed asylum claims. The government is pushing through the Illegal Migration Bill, which allows it to detain and remove undocumented migrants from the country and send them to a third country like Rwanda.
It's not all right, but it's certainly a method they're trying to use that they hope will be successful. But honestly, what we've seen is that that kind of behavior is not successful. Those kinds of policies that try to engage in deterrence and try to deter migrants and asylum seekers from coming just don't work. I mean, some of these harsh policies have resulted in a little bit of decrease of asylum seekers and migration, but very little. It's not significant. And so, it's one thing if they're an okay policy. It's another thing if they don't even work at all. So I think that, it's not in anyone's best interest.
Pakistan's parliament has been dissolved on the recommendation of Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, making way for a general election amid political and economic crises. The dissolution came a few days ahead of the end of the parliament's five-year term. It will be followed with a caretaker administration to be picked by Sharif and an opposition leader to hold new elections in 90 days. The vote, however, could be delayed several months, with the election commission set to start withdrawing hundreds of constituencies based on fresh consensus. Analysts have said any delay in the election could fuel public anger and add to uncertainty in the cash-strapped country. Pakistan has been grappling with economic crisis and record-breaking inflation as the government implemented painful reforms to secure funding from the International Monetary Fund. An American online news outlet, The Intercept, says it has obtained a document that shows Washington pushed for the removal of the former Pakistani premier from office. The United States has blacklisted dozens of Belarusian officials and entities as Washington continues sanctions as an important foreign policy tool. In a statement, the State Department said it has imposed visa bans on over 100 Belarusian officials, including several judges. Separately, the U.S. Treasury Department said it added 8 individuals and 5 entities to its Belarus sanctions list. It also identified one aircraft belonging to the Belarusian government as blocked property. The U.S. and its allies have imposed several rounds of sanctions on Belarus since President Alexander Lukashenko won elections in August 2020. The country has time and again slammed sanctions as hostile actions and said the Western countries are using pressure on a sovereign state. Russia says it has downed 11 Ukrainian drones near Crimea overnight and 2 more flying toward the capital, Moscow. The Russian Defense Ministry said the 2 drones were shot down near the city of Sevastopol off the Crimean coast, and another 9 were intercepted and crashed in the Black Sea. The ministry added that there were no reports of damage or casualties in any of the affected areas. The strikes come one day after Russia said 2 Ukrainian UAVs were shot down over an area near Moscow. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials reported the destruction of a fuel depot by Russian drones in the west of the country. The 2 countries have intensified cross-border drone strikes in recent weeks. The military junta that took control of Niger in a coup last month has announced a new government. The junta leader, General Tchiani, has named Ali Mahman Lamine Zane as the prime minister of a 21-member new cabinet. The announcement came ahead of an emergency summit by the leaders of the Economic Community of West African States in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. ECOWAS has already imposed sanctions on Niger after rebel soldiers toppled President Mohamed Bazoum on July 26. Nigeria, that has the rotating presidency of the bloc, has called for a diplomatic resolution to the crisis in Niger, but says it does not rule out military intervention. ECOWAS has pledged all necessary measures to restore constitutional order in Niger. And that does for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to A Better You. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
A joint naval exercise meant to show Beijing and Moscow's close strategic relationship has just ended near Alaska. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The South China Morning Post has covered this story and tells us more. The U.S. military's heightened response to a Russian-Chinese flotilla near Alaska was meant to send a message of force, according to a Chinese military analyst. What we see now is a flexing of muscles as the Ukraine war continues. Former People's Liberation Army instructor Song Zhongping emphasized. Song Zhongping added, "The U.S. wants to underscore that it is the real leading power in the North Atlantic by stepping up its response to the joint patrol by the Chinese and Russian navies." According to U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan, four U.S. Navy destroyers, along with a P-8 Poseidon maritime patrol aircraft, were sent last week to monitor the Russian and Chinese flotilla of 11 vessels. It came nearly a year after a U.S. Coast Guard ship encountered a 7-vessel Chinese-Russian fleet sailing about 75 nautical miles north of Kiska Island in the Alaskan waters. Last summer, the Chinese and Russian navies conducted a similar operation off the coast of Alaska, Senator Dan Sullivan emphasized. He continued, "Given that our response was tepid, I strongly encourage senior military leaders to be ready with a much more robust response should such another joint Chinese-Russian naval operation occur off our coast. I was heartened to see that this latest incursion was met with four U.S. Navy destroyers, which sends a strong message to President Xi Jinping and President Putin that the United States will not hesitate to protect and defend our vital national interests in Alaska," the senator said, referring to the Chinese and Russian leaders. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry said the joint exercise involved communications training, helicopter landings and takeoffs from the decks of each other's ships. There was also a joint anti-submarine exercise in the southwestern part of the Bering Sea. Former People's Liberation Army instructor Song Zhongping said the joint naval exercise, which also involved a passage through the Sea of Japan, was meant to highlight the close relationship between the two countries amid the war in Ukraine. With their no-limit ties, Beijing and Moscow want to show their determination to strengthen their strategic cooperation, Song Zhongping said. Just like the U.S. freedom of navigation in the backyard of China in the Asia-Pacific, the People's Liberation Army and Russian military want to show they can sail and operate anywhere as international law allows. The Beijing-based naval expert Li Ji said the stepped-up response by the U.S. showed that Washington was concerned about the collaboration between China and Russia in the Arctic. Alaskan waters are part of the Arctic shipping routes. The joint naval drills have again reminded the United States of China's role in Russia's Arctic strategy, the naval expert Li Ji said. He added, "Russia would likely see greater financial support from Beijing to finance its ambitious North Pole exploration. However, Drew Thompson, a visiting senior research fellow at the National University of Singapore's Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, said the Alaska drill might backfire on Beijing, particularly in relation to its criticism of U.S. freedom of navigation missions in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait. "It strikes me how difficult it is for China to continue claiming that U.S. military operations in the Western Pacific are an obstacle to improving relations when it conducts military operations off the U.S. coast on a recurring basis," Drew Thompson said. He added, "It is time for China to accept U.S. military missions on its periphery and engage in military-to-military dialogue if it wants to be treated as a major world power." The Islamic Republic of Iran's Mehr news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. A large group of Russian and Chinese warships passed near the coast of Alaska last week with a group of U.S. destroyers scrambling to shadow the naval patrol, according to U.S. defense officials and lawmakers, Russia Today reported. In a statement on Saturday, two Republican senators representing the state of Alaska, Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan, said a total of 11 ships had been detected transiting U.S. waters in the Aleutians, citing a classified briefing and labeling the activities an incursion. Republican Senator Dan Sullivan said he was pleased to see a robust U.S. response involving four American destroyers to the joint military exercises by China and Russia. Meanwhile, the U.S. Northern Command has confirmed that Russian and Chinese ships were indeed conducting a patrol in the area, but did not provide details on the number of ships involved. The agency's spokesperson also noted, according to the Wall Street Journal, that air and maritime assets under our commands conducted operations to assure the defense of the U.S. and Canada. However, the official did not confirm the senator's remarks about an incursion, stressing that the Chinese-Russian force remained in international waters and was not considered a threat. Brent Sadler, a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, has called the patrol a historical first and highly provocative, considering tensions over Taiwan and the Ukraine conflict, the Wall Street Journal reported. On Friday, the Russian Defense Ministry stated that Moscow's Navy was continuing its patrols in the Pacific together with Chinese warships sailing through the Sea of Japan, La Perouse Strait, the Sea of Okhotsk, and the Kamchatka Strait. It added that the drill involved a joint anti-submarine exercise as well as helicopter landings and takeoffs from the decks of each other's ships. Commenting on the military exercises, Liu Pengyu, a spokesman for the Chinese embassy in Washington, insisted that this action is not targeted at any third party and has nothing to do with the current international and regional situation, apparently referring to the Ukraine conflict and the standoff between Washington and Beijing over Taiwan. U.S. national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story. The nearly dozen Russian and Chinese ships that sailed near Alaska's Aleutian Islands last week as part of a joint naval exercise, leading the U.S. to deploy warships and aircraft to monitor the formation, are now moving away from the region, according to two American officials. In response to the ship's movements near the island chain, four U.S. Navy destroyers operating in the Pacific Ocean had monitored the ship's movements from various distances, one of the U.S. officials confirmed. Both officials stressed that the 11 Russian and Chinese warships remained in international waters and did not sail into U.S. territorial waters, which stretch out 12 miles from the Alaskan coastline. U.S. officials declined to provide details on how close the Russian and Chinese ships got to American territory. The patrol marked an apparent show of military unity and strength between the two countries. One of the officials told ABC News that Russian and Chinese vessels operated in different locations and were not always in the same formation. Video posted by Russia's Defense Ministry on Saturday showed what appeared to be at least 9 vessels sailing in formation and the firing of weapons into the ocean, presumably as part of what it described as an anti-submarine exercise. The Russian Defense Ministry said the joint patrol had already covered 2,300 nautical miles in a transit that had taken the Russian and Chinese Navy ships to the southwestern part of the Bering Sea, where they had practiced joint tactical maneuvering, conducted communications training, and carried out helicopter landings and takeoffs from the decks of each other's ships. A U.S. official told ABC News that the Pentagon was tracking and expecting this patrol for several weeks, since well before the exercises began. In addition to the four U.S. destroyers, a U.S. Navy P-8 maritime surveillance aircraft was also used to monitor the joint Russian-Chinese naval patrols, according to officials.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Hidden Files.
Years ago, wars were fought with tanks, rifles, machine guns, chemical weapons, explosive devices, etc. Well, fast forward, and wars have gotten much more sophisticated. And at times, the most lethal weapon is intangible. From misinformation, media campaigns to sanctions, the tools of war have changed to target nations and to cause upheaval from within first, and then add the more common hardware tools to the chest, like WMDs, IEDs, phosphorus bombs and missiles, and, you know, great technological advancement like those. Just as there are alleged rules to traditional warfare that are not followed, so are there alleged rules to this new form of warfare. Not targeting civilian populations and not inflicting collective punishment and not committing crimes against humanity. These are all nice concepts, which are not always followed. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today we will look at a form of war which many do not understand the effects of, sanctions, and especially the unilateral sanctions regime of the United States. According to the United Nations, sanctions are meant to be used as a last resort. It says it is a response to stopping extremism, curbing smuggling, and massive human rights violations. However, what has been the norm of the UN is that countries which are members of the Security Council are not sanctioned, and the sanction of others depends on the political and geostrategic interests of Security Council members. Well, the main sanction regime today comes from the United States and its unilateral sanctions. Washington sanctions a country and pressures other countries from dealing with the targeted sanctioned country, usually by economic threats or even worse. According to the United Nations, a proliferation of secondary sanctions has resulted in a growing fear of sanctions and overcompliance, leading to serious adverse effects on the human rights of millions of people around the world. Secondary sanctions are intended to prevent third parties, states, commercial entities, and individuals from trading with countries that are subject to sanctions issued by another country. We will talk about the legality of these unilateral sanctions a little bit later in the show.
Currently, a third of the world's population is affected by U.S. sanctions. Since 1990, the U.S. has imposed unilateral sanctions in over 20 countries. Countries that try to have independent policies from the United States are the most affected. Countries like Cuba, which has been on the U.S. sanctioned list for 61 years now. Iran, which was the most sanctioned country in history until the start of the Russia-Ukraine war. Iran has been on the U.S. sanctions list for 43 years, and now Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world. Then there is Venezuela, which has suffered for years from U.S. sanctions due to its revolutionary policies. According to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, 40,000 Venezuelans have died due to U.S. sanctions.
I'd like to welcome our first guest to the show.
Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan is a peace and social justice advocate who became internationally prominent after her son Casey was killed in Iraq in 2004. She set up a peace camp near then-President George Bush's vacation home in Crawford, Texas. She is an author and hosts The Soapbox on Substack.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Cindy. I'd like to hear your opinion on the way sanctions have been used to cause maximum pressure on countries and their populations.
Sanctions are supposedly put in place because the United States, the State Department, the politicians, the media, you know, whatever, this big class of propagandists, they'll say that so-and-so is killing his own people, so-and-so is a brutal dictatorship, blah, blah, blah. And so the United States, they're, you know, and Cuba is a perfect example of this. There's been a blockade in Cuba almost as long as I have been alive. And they're supposedly placed there so the people will get so disadvantaged and so upset with their own governments that they'll rise up against their governments. But as you know, a victim living in a place where there's been really harsh sanctions, that's not exactly what happens. And it actually is harmful to the people. And I believe, and I've talked to many people in the countries that you mentioned, and I've been to Cuba many times, it makes them stronger to stay firm against the empire, against imperialism, against neoliberalism.
Well, the irony of these U.S. sanctions is that the American people actually don't benefit from what their country is doing to others. So who's benefiting from this, Cindy?
The war profiteers, the globalists, the capitalists. They're the ones that profit. But we've seen here in the United States that even though it was a slow march to the collapse of our economic system here in the United States, especially since 2011, we've seen since the start of COVID, we've seen since the brutal sanctions put against Russia this year, that it is actually now starting to reflect here in the United States with gas prices and inflation, hyperinflation, the reduction of services, the crumbling of our infrastructure. So these sanctions are coming home to roost.
And any final comments that you have, Cindy, on this issue?
Many people are starting to wake up to that fact. And so while corporate media is collapsing, we're seeing the rise of alternative media and a rise of truth seekers. So there's still hope. And it's like talking person to person. I'm here in California at 8 o'clock in the morning. You're in Iran, 10 and a half hours away from me. And we know, just like exposing the truth from real humans, real workers, real people who are experiencing, you know, the good and the bad, and how we can work together for peace and for economic security and environmental sustainability for the entire world.
Oh, thank you so much, Cindy Sheehan, for being with us right here on Hidden Files.
One of the main messages broadcast about people, such as those living in Afghanistan, Venezuela, and Iran, is that they are suffering. We watch corporate media pump out story after story of the suffering of these people living in non-U.S. ally countries and tell how their pain, unlike that of people in Western countries, is the doing of violent criminals ruling their country without popular support. The part the media often entirely skips, however, is the role of the West in causing these issues. A role that can almost be summarized in a single word: sanctions. Sanctions are also known as unilateral coercive economic measures, which means that they are ways for, say, the U.S., to coerce governments of sovereign nations to give in to their demands. The U.S. has the power to do this because the petrodollar system gives the U.S. dollar elevated status as the dominant currency in the global economy. And due to its dominance, it can also punish other governments if they continue to do business with the targets of these coercive measures. In this way, American officials aim to either make the government of the target country obey them or make its people so desperate that they'll overthrow their government in hopes of improving their situation. And the U.S. has used this form of economic warfare since the 1950s on a host of different nations like North Korea, Cuba, Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and others. Some of the toughest of all sanctions have been imposed on Iran, and politicians like Rudy Giuliani have openly said they are working because they make the people suffer. The biggest victims of this economic terrorism are people with rare diseases who cannot access essential medicines because of these sanctions and often die as a result.
Well, let me welcome our next guest to Hidden Files.
Alfred Maurice de Zayas. De Zayas is an expert for civil and political rights and has published 9 books on a variety of legal and historical issues. He has been visiting professor of law at numerous universities, including the University of British Columbia in Canada, the Graduate Institute of the University of Geneva, the DePaul University Law School in Chicago, the Human Rights Institute at the Irish National University, Galway, and the University of Trier, Germany. At present, he teaches international law at the Geneva School of Diplomacy.
Oh, welcome to the program, Mr. De Zayas. Let's start off with your perspective on unilateral coercive measures, otherwise known as sanctions.
What must be clear to every listener is that sanctions kill. I mean, sanctions kill just as much as a bullet. Sanctions kill when you siege a town, like the Nazis siege Leningrad. That cost between 700 and 1 million human lives. Now, the sanctions that the United States has imposed on Venezuela are estimated to have cost, in the year 2018 alone, 40,000 deaths. Now, when you add all the deaths attributable to unilateral coercive measures against Cuba, against Nicaragua, against Venezuela, against Syria, against Iran, you're going to go into the hundreds of thousands of deaths. And this is not an exaggeration. UNICEF carried out an investigation of sanctions against Iraq back in the 1990s. And the estimate is that 500,000 children died because of the sanctions.
Wow, unbelievable. I mean, you say that sanctions are killing people. Can there be international legal measures taken against these sanctions?
In the light of worldwide deaths, certainly of more than 100,000 human beings directly attributable to United Nations sanctions, this is a matter for Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. This clearly falls under Article 7 of the Statute of Rome, the Statute of the International Criminal Court. That is the article on crimes against humanity. This is what has to be argued in the General Assembly. This is what has to be argued in the Security Council. This is what has to be argued at DESA and all other United Nations agencies. We already have the excellent reports of Alena Dohan. She is the UN Special Rapporteur on the adverse impacts of sanctions, not only U.S. sanctions, also sanctions imposed by the United Kingdom and by Canada and by France and Germany, et cetera, et cetera. They all kill. And that is so important that the mainstream media pick up on this piece of news. As I say, my American friends know nothing about this. They know nothing about the fact that sanctions kill. They assume that sanctions are there for good reasons to persuade governments to cease violating human rights. So the hypocrisy of it, the, shall we say, the cynicism of it is mind-boggling. But that is the situation we are living in. So my appeal, which I made in my book, Building a Just World Order, is that this issue be before the International Criminal Court. But in the meantime, it can also go up to the International Court of Justice, because the General Assembly, if you get enough votes in the General Assembly, so majority plus one, you can adopt the resolution elevating the question, the legal question of the illegality of unilateral coercive measures under the UN Charter, and elevate it to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion.
Well, what do you think the overall goal is for Washington and its sanctions regime?
Our government, there is what we term the deep state. And the deep state is made up of the military, industrial, digital, financial complex. Essentially, they call the shots. And they're making money. They're making plenty of money with war. They're certainly making a lot of money with the Ukraine war. And they're certainly making a lot of money with the sanctions. So the sanctions is a way, for instance, to prevent countries to do free trade and to buy cheaper where they can in the world. What sanctions have done, and people don't seem to realize it, sanctions have upturned, frustrated, subverted the benefits of globalization. Sanctions have essentially destroyed globalization and the supply chains and everything that goes with it. So that the United States, by weaponizing the dollar, is trying to impose on the rest of the world the U.S. imperial wishes. And as I said, I'm an American citizen, but I think like Noam Chomsky or like Jeffrey Sachs or like Dan Kovalik or Francis Boyle or Stephen Kinzer, who just abhor the weaponization of human rights actually to hurt people. And that exactly is what we're doing, but that with the complicity of the mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, CNN, Fox, and the others.
What can be done to counter these measures?
Until we realize that we are being lied to day in, day out, and that we are in the United States, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, in France, in Germany, in Switzerland, we won't be able to make any progress. So what can we do? Certainly give it publicity in the General Assembly, certainly give it publicity in the Security Council, appeal to UNICEF to carry out an investigation of the deaths attributable to sanctions, appeal to the WHO to carry out an investigation of deaths attributable to lack of access to medicine. Similarly, an appeal to the Food and Agriculture Organization, and then elevate the issue to the International Court of Justice. Is this a crime against humanity? Does this amount to a violation of Article 7 of the Statute of Rome? I have no hesitation to say that it does.
Well, do you think that these unilateral sanctions help to create an alliance between those countries which have been sanctioned?
The mindset in Washington is still the mindset of the unipolar world. And the United States just simply is striking right and left and imposing sanctions and intimidating countries and actually engaging in terror against governments, and has an enormous responsibility, both civil responsibility and criminal responsibility, for the consequences of those sanctions. But there again, that is what I say. and what Richard Falk says and what Jeffrey Sachs says. But that is not what you're going to read in the New York Times and in the Washington Post. And thus far, I don't see the American media changing. I see the American media as the spokes, as the spokesperson, as the sounding board of the Pentagon and the sounding board of the State Department. So don't expect any level of self-criticism inside the established media. You can read very good analysis in the so-called alternative media.
Are there any final comments you have on this, Mr. DeZayas?
You will see that there's plenty of Americans who think like I do. On the other hand, none of us is in a position of power. None of us is in a position that we can actually influence policy. And we can write our articles and write our analysis and hope that some people who are in a position of power will say, that makes sense. Why not try that? Why not shift? Why not try a different paradigm than the unipolar paradigm that we now have?
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Alfred DeZayas. As many countries continue to be affected by the sanctions regime, there's growing solidarity between many of the targeted countries and increased cooperation between them. These nations have had to be resilient and had to count on their own ingenuity to survive and, for many others, even thrive during these sanctions. And now it appears that the pendulum of global power is swinging and it is heading towards the east. This should be a very interesting journey, and Hidden Files will keep you informed during this process. Well, it has been a pleasure being with you on this episode of Hidden Files, and hopefully you will join us next week. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran's foreign minister attends the Joint Economic Cooperation Commission in South Africa as part of efforts to boost bilateral ties between Tehran and Pretoria. Palestinians hold a funeral procession